My Jonathan, I love you. I love you for finding the part of me that I never thought I'd find. I love you for wanting and needing me by your side. I love you for trusting me with your heart, your pride, your wisdom, and soul. I love you for the intimate exchange we share. I love you for me being the one you choose to care for. I love you for hope and faith in our future together. I love you for giving me a new perspective on life. I love you for wanting to live for God. I love you for seeing more than my parts and pieces and loving all of who I am. I love you for believing in me and all that I have to offer. I love you for so many reasons. I've only written a few, but in all that years bring to us, I never want you to forget that you were made for me. I was made for you. Love, your first true love, Sabrina. It was Valentine's Day in 2014, and Sabrina Limone was writing a love letter to her boyfriend, Jonathan Hearn, which might sound like a nice, normal thing to do, but there were many unconventional things about Sabrina and Jonathan's relationship. Sure, Sabrina was 33 and Jonathan was 24, but that wasn't a big deal. The problem was that as Sabrina was writing this letter to Jonathan, she was married to her husband Robert of 14 years. Sabrina and Robert had met back when Sabrina was just 18 years old and living in Arizona. They now lived on Strawberry Lane in a small desert community called Silver Lakes in Hellendale, California. Robert worked at BNSF Railroad and Sabrina worked at a local Costco. They had two small children, an 11-year-old boy and an 8-year-old girl. From the outside, it always seemed to neighbors and friends as though Sabrina and Robert's marriage was perfect. But within just 6 months of Sabrina sending that letter to her secret boyfriend, Jonathan, one of the three people in this love triangle, so to speak, would end up dead. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 40. At 6:47 p.m. on August 17, 2014, Kern County Sheriff's deputies responded to a call about a male bleeding at the BNSF Railroad warehouse in Tehachapi, California. According to the 911 dispatcher, a man had shown up to work at BNSF and found a very unusual scene. One of his coworkers was lying on the ground, bleeding, and the interior office of the warehouse had been ransacked. When the deputies arrived, they saw a man outside kneeling down on the ground, about 50 yards away from an open warehouse door. The man was crying and panicking, and he pointed towards the warehouse and said, "He has two kids." When they entered the warehouse, they saw broken glass and paperwork on the ground that led to a man's body lying against the driver's side wheel of a pickup truck. The man was lying in a pool of blood, a visible lump on top of his head. One eye looked like it had been shot, and the other was closed. The man's arm was purple, and there were signs of lividity, meaning the man was deceased. Paramedics arrived at the scene fairly quickly, and they checked the man for signs of life, but couldn't find any. 38-year-old Robert Limone was dead from multiple gunshot wounds. The office of the BNSF warehouse looked as though it had been staged to look like a robbery, something one of the lead detectives noticed right away. Investigators pulled surveillance video from nearby businesses and tried to identify all the vehicles they saw coming and going on Goodrick Road, the road where the warehouse was located, during the time of the murder. They were able to identify all vehicles except for one, a man on a motorcycle, wearing a helmet and a black backpack, who was seen pulling up to the warehouse just before the murder and leaving shortly after. It wasn't long before detectives had their sights on a main suspect, thanks to friends of Sabrina's and Robert's, who had told police that Sabrina had been having an affair with a man named Jonathan Hearn. Not only that, but Jonathan was still coming around, even months after Robert's murder, something their friends thought was suspicious. Detectives noticed that Jonathan looked an awful lot like the man on the motorcycle from the surveillance video, and they quickly discovered that Jonathan did, in fact, own a motorcycle himself. Detectives reviewed surveillance video from a gas station that would be on the way between the BNSF warehouse and where Jonathan lived in Hesperia, California. And sure enough, there was the man on the motorcycle again, although now in a different set of clothing. Detectives got a warrant for Jonathan's cell phone records, and while there was no activity on his phone around the time of the murder, they noticed that Sabrina's phone number was listed on the records, although at first, it looked like their communication had ceased months prior to Robert's murder. But there was also a number on there that was constantly in contact with Jonathan, and when they tried to pull the records from that phone, they learned that it was a burner phone belonging to Sabrina. And so detectives began wiretapping their phone calls from both Jonathan and Sabrina's phones to see if they could learn anything about who was responsible for Robert's murder. Jonathan and Sabrina spoke to each other multiple times a day. They expressed their love for each other, spoke about their religious beliefs and how it was God's purpose for them to be together, and they often spoke about the investigation as well. The lead detective in the case, Detective Robert Randall Meyer, decided to start feeding Sabrina some information from their investigation to see if it would elicit some sort of reaction between Jonathan and Sabrina. On November 10th, Detective Meyer called Sabrina and told her that they had great news. They had found DNA from two drops of sweat at the crime scene. Sabrina responded, "Really? Oh gosh, that's great." After she got off the phone with Detective Meyer, Sabrina called Jonathan and told him about the DNA. Jonathan thanked her for telling him and said that he will, quote, keep praying for the whole situation. They then discussed what it could mean, and Jonathan said how he thinks you have to be in their system for them to match anyone to the DNA. A few days later, on November 17th, Detective Meyer called Sabrina again with more good news about the investigation.
I was reviewing some video from the area about the time when the murder occurred. And about that time, we could see a motorcycle leaving the area, and it appeared to be a white male skinny that was leaving the area at the time around when the murder occurred. Also, I've been going through the secret witness tips, and I got a tip today that said that we should be looking at a subject named John, like a J-O-N, and this person possibly being robbed.
Sabrina then called Jonathan again and filled him in on what Detective Meyer had said, that they had surveillance video of the suspect and that a secret witness had told them to look into someone named John. While they were on the phone, Detective Meyer sent her a photo from the surveillance video. The text read, "Sabrina, we think this is our guy. Do you recognize the person on the motorcycle?" Sabrina read the text out loud to Jonathan and described what the man on the motorcycle was wearing. They began to pray together, and Jonathan said that he feels like detectives know about their affair and that they'll pull him in for questioning soon. It only makes sense that he would be their main suspect, he said. And then, on November 18th, 2014, while Sabrina was at the Hellendale Elementary School, she was taken into custody and arrested. And shortly after, Jonathan was arrested while at work at the Redlands Fire Department. Jonathan refused to speak to detectives, but Sabrina wanted to talk. She admitted that Jonathan knew where Robert worked because she had told him, but she adamantly denied having any knowledge of Jonathan killing him and said that she didn't believe that he would ever do something like that. She admitted to having hid their affair, saying that she had been ashamed and didn't want her family to know. But as far as having anything to do with Robert's death, Sabrina continued to deny that she had. The detectives didn't believe her. One of them said, quote, "I think you set your husband up to be killed by Jonathan so you two could be together. And I'm going to tell you, that's not going to ever happen, ever. He's going to prison for the rest of his life, and I've got some serious doubts about you." He said there was absolutely no reason why Sabrina would tell her boyfriend where her husband was working. He asked her why she did that, and she didn't answer, only said no. Sabrina was put into handcuffs and booked into jail. But a few months later, she would be released. Citing not enough evidence to convict her, prosecutors dropped the charges against Sabrina. And so Sabrina continued on with her life. She and her two children packed up and moved away from the Silver Lakes community, seemingly ready to start a new life. Sabrina had even started dating again. But about 2 years later, in 2017, just weeks before his trial was scheduled to begin, Jonathan told investigators that he wanted to talk. And not only did he confess to shooting and killing Robert, but he told police that Sabrina had been in on it. Jonathan agreed to a plea deal, perhaps an even controversial one. In exchange for testifying against Sabrina, he agreed to serve just 25 years in prison. Sabrina was rearrested in January 2017 and charged with 6 felonies, including murder, conspiracy to commit murder, soliciting murder, attempted murder, poisoning, and being an accessory after the fact. But going into her trial, it seemed as though the only evidence against her was the testimony from Jonathan, a sort of he said, she said situation. The trial drew national attention, and I have to say that this was probably the most requested trial from my listeners that I have ever received for this podcast. Everyone was fascinated by a story that seemed to have all the components made for a lifetime movie: sex, betrayal, murder, religion. But unfortunately, this wasn't a lifetime movie. It was real life. And the question that everyone wanted to know was Sabrina really the mastermind behind her husband's killing? Or was she just guilty of having an affair with the man who then went and eliminated him from the equation? Sabrina's trial started on September 11th, 2017. Prosecutor Eric Smith spoke about Sabrina and Robert's marriage. He said that Robert worked for BNSF in Barstow, but just before his death, he was also working as a rapid responder for them, out in Tehachapi, about 2 to 4 days per month. Prosecutor Smith told the jury that Jonathan Hearn was a firefighter in nearby Redlands, California. One of his duties was to pick up food from Costco for the firehouse. And one day in 2012, he met Sabrina there as she was working, and in the months following, they began an affair. Smith said that affair led to the death of Robert Lamone. Smith called Robert hardworking, a friend to everyone, and a father of two. He told the jury that they'll hear from the mouths of Sabrina and Jonathan about their plan to get rid of him so they could be together, and so she could get in excess of $300,000 in life insurance and lifelong benefits from the railroad. Smith said they'll hear countless text messages and phone calls back and forth, photos and letters that were exchanged. In April 2013 and March 2014, Robert confronted Jonathan about the affair, but it continued. Smith said that Sabrina and Jonathan conspired about ways to kill Robert. They decided in April 2014 to try and poison him, but they got cold feet about doing it that way and backed out at the last minute. Shortly after that, Jonathan bought Sabrina a burner phone, and that's what they used while continuing to plan Robert's murder. They decided that Jonathan would go shoot and kill Robert while he was at work in Tehachapi. Jonathan purchased clothes from the Salvation Army, bought a mask, and built a silencer. He surveilled the BNSF warehouse and took photos of it beforehand. Meanwhile, Sabrina provided information to him, including where the warehouse was located and when Robert was scheduled to work. So on August 17th, 2014, while Robert was at work, Jonathan got on his motorcycle and went to Tehachapi. He wore a mask that looked like an old man, and as he approached Robert, Robert offered to get him something to drink, not knowing that it was Jonathan. Jonathan fired 2 shots and then fled on his motorcycle. He then texted Sabrina and called her when he got home. Smith said that when they started their investigation, police asked Sabrina if she had been having an affair, or if there were any marital problems between her and Robert, and she said no. But due to Sabrina and Robert's friends calling detectives about Jonathan, the investigation focused on him. Smith said they got his DMV info and learned that he had a motorcycle, the same type of motorcycle that was seen in the surveillance footage. And while the investigation was going on, Sabrina and Jonathan took steps to start their new life together. Jonathan went over to her house multiple times, making sure to bring a family member so it didn't look weird. He would stay the night after the kids were in bed. 19 days after Robert was killed, Smith said Sabrina texted Jonathan that she loved him and called him a sexy guy. 21 days after Robert was killed, she told him that she wanted to kiss him and not stop, that she missed him tonight, and that she loved him. 25 days after Robert was killed, Sabrina texted him, quote, "I feel super blessed." She then told him that she bought him something that they will one day share in their home. Smith read aloud more text messages from Sabrina to Jonathan in the months following Robert's death. On October 5th, 2014, Sabrina called him her partner in this life. She wrote, "So ready to live fully for you. I am ready for us. I need you." Then a few weeks later, quote, "I am in love with you deeply, a love I have never felt before." Prosecutor Smith repeated, "A love I have never felt before," and pointed out that she had been with her husband Robert for well over 10 years. He said the evidence will show that Robert was killed for money and to replace him as the father. This was their plan. This was their purpose. He asked the jury to find Sabrina guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. In his opening statement, Sabrina's attorney, Richard Terry, said the evidence will be what is presented at trial and not the prosecutor's words. He said this isn't a love triangle, that it's more like a love polygon, that it has so many sides that it's not limited to just three people. Terry also went into detail about Sabrina and Robert's marriage, saying that Sabrina met Robert when she was 18 and married him when she was 20. They moved from Arizona to California and a few years later had a son. A few years after that, they decided to have an open marriage, and they got involved in partner swapping, and they were a part of a swingers group. They would go on adult-only vacations and party and engage in sexual conduct. This was their lifestyle, Terry said. In 2012, when Sabrina met Jonathan, he approached her at Costco, and she was flattered by the attention and gave him her number. They started seeing each other, just socially at first, but over time it developed into a romantic relationship that was off and on. Terry said that Robert found out about their affair on two different occasions. The reason for Sabrina's burner phone, Terry told the jury, was to hide their affair after Robert found out about it a second time. Jonathan kept pursuing Sabrina, and she was enamored with the attention from this younger, intelligent man. Terry said she fell in love with that feeling of being wanted just for herself and not just as a sex toy that her husband passed around. Terry argued that Sabrina didn't have a motive to want Robert dead, that there was no evidence that she knew that Jonathan was going to kill him. "Their only evidence," he said, "is Jonathan, a cold, calculated killer who stalked and killed her husband." He said Jonathan manipulated Sabrina and killed her husband. And now he will claim that she asked him to do it, but there will be no evidence to support that, Terry told the jury. "Keep an open mind and question everything." Robert's coworker, who had found his body, testified that he got to work that day at about 6:45 p.m. to relieve Robert. When he arrived, he found the shop completely closed up, and Robert was nowhere to be found. He opened the garage door and saw the truck that Robert would have been using parked inside. He thought something was off. He saw a broken light bulb on the ground and tried to figure out where it had come from. He walked over to the warehouse office and noticed that the door was open, which was unusual. He saw that the office itself was, quote, "tore apart." And at that point, he knew something was wrong. He walked back out, and as he approached Robert's truck, he saw blood on the floor.
He said he saw a glimpse of blood. There was a pool of blood that was by his head that was past the front tires. That's kind of when I came further around and seen him, and I kneeled down to him and was trying to talk to him and trying to get him to wake up.
And when you said you came around, are you talking front of the vehicle, back of the vehicle?
From the front of the vehicle.
After you walked around the front of the vehicle, how was Robert's body positioned?
His head and his shoulders were kind of leaning up on the front tire of the driver's side.
Did you move him in any way?
I did later, not at that point.
So you walked around, you see Robert, he's leaning up against the front tire?
Correct. Yeah, I knelt down to him and was, yeah, trying to talk to him, trying to get him to acknowledge me. I was just saying, Rob, what happened? And was asking, saying, wake up, buddy.
Did you get any response?
None.
He realized Robert wasn't going to respond, so he called 911. The lead detective in the case, Detective Meyer, testified about the surveillance videos they collected from nearby businesses. Portions of those videos were shown to the jury, where they could see the man on the motorcycle traveling towards and away from the warehouse around the time of the murder, and a grainy video of a man walking towards the warehouse that Meyer said was later identified as Jonathan Hearn. During their investigation, they interviewed Robert's coworkers and friends, and found that Robert really never had any problems with anyone, and that everyone seemed to genuinely like him. When he first interviewed Sabrina, she told him that she and Robert had a great marriage, and twice insisted that there was no infidelity, either on her part or on Robert's. A friend and neighbor of the Lamones, Jason Bernatine, testified that he and his wife Kelly were close with Sabrina and Robert, but Jason also knew Jonathan Hearn. He met Jonathan in 2010 or 2011, where he worked as a firefighter at the San Bernardino Fire Department. He said Jonathan was very intelligent, very well-spoken, and proper, that he could have been a doctor or a lawyer, but that he loved firefighting. Jason called him sheltered and said he didn't cuss very much. Jonathan left the station when he was hired on full-time at the Redlands Fire Department. The next time Jason encountered him after that was when Jonathan texted him and said that he had met his friend Sabrina at Costco. Jonathan wrote that he would love to hang out with all of them sometime. Jason said that Jonathan started texting him more frequently, to the point where Jason started to feel weird about it. He said he would joke with his wife Kelly that, "Hey, I think this guy likes me," and they would laugh about it. He called it odd. Then one day in March 2013, they went to a bar with a group of their friends, including Sabrina and Robert. When they got there, he saw three guys that he recognized from work. One of them was Jonathan. He said Jonathan and Sabrina were hanging out that night. He said he remembered noticing that because Jonathan was usually more reserved. A few months later, he, Kelly, and Robert were fixing up a house that Jason had just bought when he got a text message from Jonathan that read, "Hey, Jason, I need your buddy Rob's phone number. Can you call me?" Jason called him and asked him why he needed Robert's number. John told him that he had been having an affair with Sabrina and wanted to talk to him about it. Jason said he gave the phone to Robert, and they talked for about 45 minutes. Robert later told him that everything was okay, that Sabrina had had an affair with Jonathan and was embarrassed by it. About a week after Robert's death, Jason said he received a strange voicemail from Jonathan that he turned over to the police. He recalled Jonathan's and Sabrina's behavior after Robert's death and how he started contacting the detective in the case.
Did you ever see Jonathan in the area of Silver Lakes or Hallandale after the death of Robert?
Yes.
When did you see Jonathan?
I saw him drive through the intersection of Hellendale Road and Vista Road from my fire station.
Do you recall the approximate date following after Robert's
death? I don't. It was sometime within the 2 to 3 months after Rob's death.
After Robert's death, did you ever speak with Sabrina about Jonathan Murphy?
I did.
What did she tell you?
I had found out that Jonathan had brought her flowers. I had called Detective Meyer the previous Friday after Jonathan had called me, and had a meeting set up with Detective Meyer that Monday. So I called Sabrina to actually have her come and meet me when I was meeting Detective Meyer, but I did not tell her that that was the reason I needed to meet her. She did not show up at that time. She left a voicemail at 10 o'clock that night saying that she could not make it. The following morning, I called her and I had not decided if I was going to tell her that I had talked with Detective Meyer or not. But I did want to address the fact that Jonathan went to her house. And I told her that I did not trust Jonathan, that he had tried to use me in the past to get close to her. And I told her about the text messages he was sending me to try to invite him out to Silver Lakes. At that time, she told me that she doesn't have a right to turn anyone in her life away, and that she gets that guy. At that time, I decided I was not going to tell her that I had talked to Detective Meyer. That conversation lasted probably 10, 15 minutes.
Now, when you met with Detective Meyer, did you provide any letter that you had received from Jonathan?
Not at that time. I provided him with a voicemail that Jonathan had left me.
So the audio that you received from Jonathan, you gave that to Detective Meyer?
Yes. That was the Monday where I first met Detective Meyer in person. Yes, I gave him all the text messages that Jonathan had sent me.
Jason said he had been avoiding Sabrina, but ran into her and her two kids at the grocery store about a month and a half after Robert's murder. The kids started talking about Jonathan, and Sabrina quickly changed the subject and, quote, hushed them away. Jason later told Detective Meyer about it. Jason's wife, Kelly Bernatine, testified that within 2 weeks of Robert's death, she saw Jonathan multiple times in their neighborhood. Once while he was driving, and another time, she saw his truck parked outside Sabrina's house. She asked Sabrina about it, and she told her that it was someone else's. But Kelly was suspicious, so she wrote down the license plate number and gave that to Detective Meyer. Another time, she saw a black motorcycle with the words "Forgiven" airbrushed on the side of it. She took a photo of the motorcycle and got the license plate and gave that to Detective Meyer, too. She didn't bother asking Sabrina whose it was because Sabrina had already lied to her. She said Sabrina did tell her that shortly after the funeral service, Jonathan came over with flowers. She said she kept updating Detective Meyer over the phone and then went to meet with him. When asked why she spoke with him, Kelly said, her voice cracking, "Because someone killed my friend, and they needed to pay for it." Mark Reilly, an evidence technician with the Kern County Sheriff's Office, executed a search warrant on Jonathan's home in Hesperia, California, after his arrest on November 18, 2014. Photos of what were found were shown to the jury, including a motorcycle in the garage, brown shorts and a black tank top in the laundry basket, a rifle, a .45 caliber semi-automatic handgun, and letters and photographs of Sabrina. Sean Mountjoy, a deputy sheriff with the Kern County Sheriff's Office, went undercover and began surveillance on Jonathan and Sabrina shortly after they became suspects. He told the jury about one instance at a Round Table Pizza in Apple Valley.
Are you aware whether or not for sure that Jonathan Hearn and Sabrina Lamont were in a relationship when you were surveilling?
I was definitely convinced they were in a relationship.
What convinced you of that, based on what you observed?
It appeared Jonathan Hearn almost took like a father figure type of role. As he would allow the kids to play video games, like at Round Table Pizza, he'd give them a bunch of quarters. They'd go play the video games, arcade games. As he and Sabrina would sit and talk in private, they appeared very close to one another, would touch one another, hug each other, kiss, just as a normal couple would.
An officer with the BNSF Police Department reviewed phone records for Jonathan's cell phone, as well as for Sabrina's two phones. He testified about the activity between the two around the date and time of the murder. On August 1st, 2014, through August 13th, 2014, there were 1,605 text messages sent between Jonathan and Sabrina's burner phone. On August 14th, 2014, through August 15th, 2014, there were approximately 204 text messages between the two phones, including multimedia messages. On August 16th, 2014, there were 93 text messages between the two phones. And on the day of the murder, on August 17th, there was a phone call from Sabrina to Jonathan around noon. Then there were 8 text messages from 1:26 p.m. to 6:57 p.m. Then another phone call from Sabrina to Jonathan at 7:50 p.m., and a phone call from Jonathan to Sabrina at 8:37 p.m. There were then a total of 56 text messages from 8:38 p.m. through 6:48 the next morning. And on August 18th, the day after Robert's murder, there were 97 text messages and a phone call from Jonathan to Sabrina's landline, which resulted in a 134-minute phone conversation. For that entire month of August 2014, there were approximately 2,493 text messages between the two and approximately 120 phone calls. The General Director of Claims at BNSF testified that he spoke with Sabrina numerous times after Robert's death about the railroad retirement benefits and how they worked. He said he kept having to tell her that they couldn't rush it through and that they had to follow the normal process. He said in light of what happened, there was never any financial settlement paid out to Sabrina. Jonathan's father, Mike Hearn, took the stand and testified that he used to teach his children stories from the Bible, including the story of David and Bathsheba. And as to why that story might be important to this trial, the story goes something like this. King David is at home while his men are all out to war. While looking out his window, he sees a beautiful woman and asks for her to be brought to him. The woman is married, but they have an affair. She gets pregnant, and in an attempt to hide her pregnancy, they make her husband think he's the father. And then King David has the husband killed in battle. Mike said he enjoyed teaching that story to his kids because it taught them the ideas of self-control, not taking things that don't belong to you, and not lying to cover things up. After Jonathan was arrested, police told him that Jonathan had been talking about that story. He said he believed that his son could have had an affair and was capable of doing things he shouldn't do. Senior Deputy Tommy Robbins testified that he responded to Sabrina's home to execute a search warrant. Among the items seized were BNSF financial documents, a life insurance statement for Robert Lamone in the amount of $300,000, and various deposit slips from her bank, totaling more than $307,000. Sergeant Brandon Rutledge testified that after Jonathan's arrest at the Redlands Fire Department, a firearm was seized from his truck, and a black backpack was taken from his work locker. We'll see what Jonathan Hearn himself has to say about everything, right after this quick break. If you're like me, your favorite part of going to the mall as a kid was stopping by Mrs. Fields. I remember my mom would always reward me with a Mrs. Fields cookie after having to tag along with her to store after store, but it was always worth it in the end. Stopping by Mrs. Fields will probably be your favorite part of going holiday shopping this year, too. Something about that first soft bite of the perfect chocolate chip cookie just makes you feel like a kid again. This holiday season, you can give your friends and family that same feeling of pure joy with a holiday gift arrangement from Mrs. Fields. Mrs. Fields cookies have been around for 40 years. Everyone knows and everyone loves them. Remember the very first time you had one? It's like you finally knew what a chocolate chip cookie should taste like. And again, if you're at all like me, you probably tried to emulate that with your baking, but always seemed to fall short. My absolute favorite cookie at Mrs. Fields is their soft, chewy peanut butter cookies. Or maybe their frosted cinnamon sugar cookies. Those are really tasty. Or maybe they're butter cookies. Anyway, they're so soft and chocolatey, just thinking about those cookies makes my mouth water. And Mrs. Fields cookies are freshly baked and ready to enjoy right out of the box, so everyone can have what they've always wanted right now. And now that your mouth is probably watering, here's an exclusive deal for my Court Junkie listeners. Go to mrsfields.com, click on the microphone on the upper right-hand corner, and enter code JUNKIE to get 25% off Mrs. Fields' best-selling Peace, Love, and Cookies tin. You get nibblers, bite-sized cookies, brownie bites, and more. So click on the microphone and enter promo code JUNKIE at mrsfields.com to get the perfect holiday gift for 25% off. That's mrsfields.com. This episode is also brought to you by Virtue. Virtue Labs is a new hair care brand with the goal of giving everyone the best hair scientifically possible. All thanks to an incredible new protein called alpha keratin 60KU, which was discovered 6 years ago by a group of bioscientists working in restorative medicine. Unlike most hair care products that are sourced from animal byproducts, alpha keratin 60KU is a whole human protein that's identical to the keratin in your own hair. As a result, it has the power to resurface and fill in cracks from damage to change your hair's quality and appearance forever. That means more bounce, more shine, more strength, and more life for your hair. And now, you can only find it in Virtue Labs' line of shampoos, conditioners, and styling products. Not to mention, each Virtue Labs product is formulated to address specific issues, like heat damage, frizz, or thinning hair. And no joke, you'll notice a difference after the first wash. You may have seen me post about it on Instagram. I've been using Virtue for quite a few months now, and I am absolutely obsessed with the way my hair looks, feels, and even smells. My favorite product is the Perfect Ending Split End Serum, which I swear makes a huge difference. So if you're ready to experience it, my Court Junkie listeners can now try Virtue at 10% off and get free shipping with the code COURT. Visit virtuelabs.com to place your order. That's virtuelabs.com. It's time to start treating our hair with a little more humanity. It's time for Virtue. And now, back to the episode. Jonathan Hearn walked into the courtroom wearing a sport coat, a tie, and handcuffs that clinked whenever he used his hands. He said he was 27 years old now, was arrested at 24, and first met Sabrina when he was 22. He described meeting and ultimately falling in love with Sabrina. He said the second or third time he ran into her at Costco, she remembered his name. He couldn't remember hers, but thought that it was neat that she remembered his. He got her number that third time. He said she wasn't wearing a wedding ring and never said anything at first about being married. They talked and texted within a week or two, and she called him and told him that she was married. At that point, they agreed to talk just as friends, but that didn't last long. By the end of December 2012, it had turned into a full-fledged affair. He said they usually had sex at her house when Robert and the kids were away, but she would also come over to his house, too. When they weren't together, they would exchange messages and photos, many of them salacious. He said they started telling each other they loved each other pretty quickly, early in 2013. There were a number of times where he would rethink about what he was getting himself into, but it kept progressing more, which was, quote, to his shame, he said. Prosecutor Smith asked why he kept going back.
So when you were going mentally through this moral dilemma, what kept you going back to Ms. Lamont?
Just to give a sense of her personality outside of this courtroom, I know this is probably a time when she's not very talkative, but she's a very, very friendly person and a very encouraging, attentive. Almost all of her words are very kind towards everyone. She's very upbeat and just has a reserve of optimism, no matter kind of what's going on. And as I mentioned around that time, I had a number of relationships that probably were subpar, where they were not people like her. So when I met her, and she was very attentive and very encouraging and very uplifting and upbeat, and there was a sort of emotional magnetism there. I know in most affairs you would assume it's a sexual draw or something along those lines. And with her, while we were engaged in that, there was a lot more than that. I would say early 2013, it was a primarily emotional affair, though we were hooking up from time to time. I just found her to be a very entrancing person.
He said he received a phone call from Robert in March or April 2013, after Robert had come across some of his text messages to Sabrina. So about a week later, he contacted Jason Bernatine to ask for Robert's number. He and Robert talked, but Jonathan said he didn't confess to a full-on affair, only that they had a pretty serious emotional affair, and he apologized. An entry from Jonathan's journal on April 22, 2013, was shown to the jury. In it, Jonathan writes about how the affair was discovered and the emotions he felt, recognizing that he had, quote, crushed, disrespected, and hurt Mr. Lamone. He wrote that in spite of his attraction to Sabrina, ultimately he had to go through missing her in order to undo what he had done. Quote, I begged Robert's forgiveness and prayed for his salvation. God has shown me grace. Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? No way. I am blessed but torn. I cannot afford to hurt Robert again. Yet I love Sabrina. Dad said, sometimes God interrupts our lives for a reason. Another passage read, quote, ultimately, I want this woman to know that she is amazing and loved by God and me. But I cannot also disrespect, hurt, or dishonor her incredible husband. Next time, we will discover the beauty and balance of forgiveness. Forgiveness is a challenge. Jonathan said he was very conflicted by his actions, but within a month, he and Sabrina were having sex again. When asked if he tried to stay away from her, he said that he had very serious conversations with her, expressing his conflicts, but he said that he failed at making a concerted effort to stay away. Eventually, Sabrina started to speak negatively about not only her marriage, but about Robert himself. Jonathan said Sabrina told him that Robert was exploitative and objectified her, often passing her off to other men in their swinger lifestyle. She said Robert wasn't concerned with their marriage. He was focused on his own interests and not the interests of her or their kids. Prosecutor Smith asked him how he felt when Sabrina would tell him those things.
As far as my feelings, the foundation of a number of our conversations were justifying in nature. So when there were guilt, I would say, was when those things were brought up. As far as most of the negative things we discussed about Robert were not just like you or I would just discuss negative about someone that we know mutually. These were more so decidedly justifying. They were to look for justification for an affair that we were carrying on that we shouldn't have been, and obviously I felt guilt for.
The negative conversations about Robert continued into 2014 and became a regular topic of conversation. He said he listened and believed it. Jonathan was then asked about how killing Robert came about.
When did you and Sabrina, when did you begin to speak about Robert's ultimate demise?
I believe it was towards the end of 2013 or beginning of 2014.
And who did you have those conversations with?
Sabrina.
How did they progress from early 2012, early 2013, where nothing negative is said to about Robert, to where there's some complaints, to where ultimately his demise is planned?
You know, I distinctly remember it coming up in conversation as a joke at first, and I don't remember who mentioned it first, honestly, but I remember by the end of 2013, early 2014, somewhere in there, it definitely turned from humor into something that actually began to materialize.
He said they then started talking about getting married.
Was there also a plan in place what to do once he was gone?
There was. We discussed crime concealment as far as not getting detected in the first place, but then we also did discuss a future together around that time, discussing more seriously a marriage in the future.
And that's my question. What was the plan for your relationship once he was gone?
To marry and continue to live our lives together.
Did you settle on a method to kill Robert initially?
Yes, I did.
What was the initial method that you decided upon?
Poisoning.
Did you have any other methods in mind?
Briefly considered some others, yes, but
when you came up with these methods, was this by yourself or in conjunction with Miss Emma?
In conjunction with Sabrina.
How did these conversations go?
As far as planning the poisoning, or are you saying to progress to getting to poisoning him?
The initial decision as to what method you would use to try to kill Bob.
I don't remember how the conversation was came up, but obviously we were discussing killing him, and I know we briefly discussed. She asked me how I thought would be best, and we discussed, I believe, car accident and fire, and quickly skipped over those and arrived at poisoning, and then did a significant amount of discussion and planning pursuant to that.
So they decided to poison Robert. Sabrina told him about Robert's medical history, and they thought that might be their best option in order to get away with it. He said Sabrina suggested making it in banana pudding with vanilla wafers. He purchased arsenic online under an alias and had it sent to his grandparents' commercial art studio. Receipts of his purchase from March 2014 were shown to the jury. Also shown to the jury was an internet search Jonathan had done, in which he searched for, how soon after a person dies does a life insurance policy pay out? Jonathan testified that he was getting that information for Sabrina while they were planning. Jonathan said he made banana pudding with vanilla wafers and put it in a large Tupperware container, as if for Sabrina's whole family. He then made a separate, smaller container with a single-size serving that Robert could take to work. He laced this batch with arsenic and gave both to Sabrina. He said Sabrina told him that she put it in Robert's lunchbox for his next shift the next day. But on that day, Sabrina and Jonathan spoke on the phone. They discussed how they were concerned about being tracked through their cell phones if Robert died then. So Sabrina said she called Robert at work and told him that the bananas had gone bad and to not eat the pudding. Afterwards, they got Sabrina her burner phone. As for why Sabrina didn't just want to divorce Robert, she told Jonathan that her friends and family would side with Robert and that she didn't want the kids to live in a dual household. She told him that Robert would rather be dead than divorced and that losing her would essentially kill him. Around February or March 2014, Jonathan made a list of things that Sabrina had told him about Robert. The list was shown to the jury and read, in part, "Refusing God even while ill. Gave his wife away to another man to share passionate experience that humans can share together. Gave his wife away to other women. Wants to have a threesome. Defied the living God. Please kill him, God. I love you. My vision has not changed. Divorce or wait for Rob to leave. God's punishment." By the time he wrote that, he said he had a, quote, frank disgust for Robert, which led him to be dismissive of his life. He and Sabrina then decided that Jonathan would just approach him at work and shoot him. He detailed Sabrina's contributions to their plan.
When you're planning or lead up to the second attempt, what information did Sabrina provide you?
Well, she described the facility for me, because I didn't have knowledge of the layout or whatnot. So she expressed that it was a industrial building at the end of a long road, and its proximity to some houses nearby. She didn't tell me that part. She just said it was an industrial facility at the end of a long road. And then she offered to find me pictures of the facility that she thought she had from before. Later on, shortly before, she described the office layout and the interior. She verbally described the interior to give me a kind of an idea of what to expect inside. She gave me some other sort of heads up or advice on avoiding detection, as far as she told me that the responder vehicles at the location had recently installed forward facing cameras on the utility trucks, and just obviously to avoid the front of the truck. Just, I guess, little incidental concerns, like she had expressed that it would be better that I take my motorcycle instead of my truck, because I drove a pretty loud diesel truck at that time, and my motorcycle was quieter. At that time, it was my intention and expressed to her that my thought was to go out at nighttime, and because he worked occasionally at night shifts out there. So the idea of a quieter vehicle, just so as to not wake people up or you know, have witnesses potentially. So we discussed the location, some of those other incidental concerns, but trying to think. I know as I needed specific logistical information, she was able to provide some of those things.
At one point in their planning, Sabrina asked to delay it because her mother was ill. But at another point, she wanted to expedite their plans because she and Robert had an annual trip planned near the end of August, and Sabrina didn't want to go. So she was pushing for him to do it so that she wouldn't have to go. He said any time Robert's work schedule would change, she would let him know. On the day of the murder, August 17th, Jonathan left work at the Redlands Fire Department at 8 a.m. and went to a Walmart near his home to get some ammunition. He said he wanted to get ammunition that was unlike the kind he already had at home. When he got home, he made some final preparations on a silencer he was planning on using. He then left and went to an area just south of where he lived to test out the silencer. He then went back home and started preparing to leave for Tehachapi. He packed two backpacks with a mask, change of clothes he had bought from a thrift store, and extra ammunition. He used adhesive flashing to modify parts of his motorcycle so it would look different.
As you were making these preparations, did you speak with Sabrina Lowe?
I did.
Did you tell her of some of your preparations?
I did.
Which of your preparations did you inform her of?
All of them. I shouldn't say all of them. I didn't exactly explain everything I was doing, but she asked me how I was feeling. She asked me if I could be detected, and so I explained the clothing and the mask that I didn't think I would be recognized. She asked me about my motorcycle, if that would be noticeable, because it did have custom lettering on it, and I explained that I was taking measures to disguise the motorcycle as well. I don't remember the intricate details. I remember that as I was working, I was speaking to her on a hands-free mode, so my mind was with some of my work, probably more as opposed to paying full attention to our conversation, but I do remember having a lengthy conversation with her that morning.
Did she express any other concerns, whether it be for whether or not you'd be detected, your safety, anything of that nature?
She did. One thing she mentioned in that conversation was just to be careful, because she knew that, or she told me that Robert would likely put up a fight and could fight. She also expressed that she thought I was kind of getting a late start because I was still at home, and based on the time it takes to get from where I lived all the way up to Tehachapi, I ran the risk of Robert's oncoming relief maybe arriving around that time. So she expressed that she thought I was kind of getting a late start, and so just be careful.
As for what he and Sabrina talked about if they were to get caught, they had a plan for that too.
What did you and Sabrina talk about in the context of avoiding detection once an investigation was started?
Well, we first and foremost, we're hoping to not need to use any alibi, and hopefully it would be investigated as a robbery, we discussed. But in the event that investigation was pointed at her, I encouraged her not to mention our affair at all, just because that would obviously open a room for scrutiny. But in the event that they did discover me and her and that we had had an ongoing affair, our agreed upon alibi was that any indicia of like us being sneaky about anything was more so to hide the fact that we'd been having an affair as opposed to anything more than that.
After he left his house that day on his motorcycle, he went to Robert's work at BNSF. He didn't take his cell phone with him, so it wouldn't be traced. He had trouble finding the building, so he almost decided to call it off. He was getting ready to leave when he saw Robert drive in and open the BNSF garage door. He said he was eager to get it over with, even though he struggled with the thought of senselessly taking someone's life. But although he couldn't explain it, he said he felt like it had to inevitably be done. He said a prayer and watched Robert for a while. He then entered the building.
At that time, Robert approached, came out from the office. He had been in the office area, which is in the back corner of the garage. And we briefly spoke. I don't have distinct recollection right now.
What distance were you from Rob when you saw him?
Within 10 feet.
You said that you had a mask with you. Were you wearing the mask at that time?
I was.
What did the mask look like?
Just an older man appearance.
Where were you at when you spoke to Rob?
In the entrance, near the entrance of where the garage door was.
Where did you proceed from there?
Down the north side of the truck that was parked there in a little walkway. He went to retrieve some things, and as was my intention, I went to pull out a firearm. However, the gun kind of was, or the silencer was kind of stuck in the corner of the backpack that I had. So, ultimately sort of followed him with one hand in this bag trying to retrieve a gun, and at some point he turned around, which was around the time when I fired the first shot from within the bag.
Jonathan identified the handgun in court.
After you fired the first shot, what happened to Robert?
He fell, seemingly mortally wounded.
After he fell, what did you do?
So as to avoid the front of the truck that was parked right there because of the cameras, I went around the back of the vehicle and then headed up into the office to follow through with the previously discussed plan of sort of overturning the interior of the office and making it look like a robbery.
Jonathan looked down as he spoke. He said he ransacked the office and put some papers and a laptop into his backpack. But as he was about to leave, he had second thoughts about whether Robert was really dead.
I headed for the entrance again, so as to exit. But previously when I had shot Rob and he fell, he had exhaled in a way that made me believe he was dead, but I questioned that as I was about to leave, thinking I really didn't want to leave him if he wasn't entirely dead. So I went back around the backside of the truck and quickly fired one more shot at him, and then closed the garage door behind me.
He got back on his motorcycle and drove to a secluded area where he took off his motorcycle license plate and changed his clothes. He then stopped at a gas station. The surveillance video from that stop was played for the jury, showing him in a different outfit as before. He then drove home. When he got there, he got his cell phone, which he had left behind, and saw that he had a lot of missed calls from Sabrina, so he called her back.
What did you tell her?
Well, the conversation went something to the effect of that she was worried. She expressed that she was glad to hear from me. She was worried she hadn't heard from either of us and had been trying to call both of us, and referring to both me and Robert, and was very worried because it had been a lot later than she'd anticipated that I was getting home. she wanted to make sure I was okay, and I did express that I don't remember the exact words that I used, but that I had done it, and that everything was about to change. All the preliminary discussions that we had had about anticipating all the pressure that was about to be applied as far as to her life. I seem to remember making a couple encouraging or attempts at encouraging remarks, just to be strong kind of thing.
He destroyed the laptop and drove it to a dumpster in the back of an industrial building. He said he was paranoid and burdened by the fact that he had just committed a really egregious act. When asked if he thought he would be a suspect because he had been having an affair with Sabrina, he said yes. But he said he trusted Sabrina wouldn't say anything because they had planned it together. Jonathan said that he and Sabrina were concerned about Jason and Kelly Bernatine because they were the only ones who knew that they had been involved in an affair prior to Robert's murder. He said it was their intention to gradually distance themselves from them. He said he texted Jason 2 weeks after the murder and wrote a letter to Jason and Kelly to reintroduce himself into Sabrina's life and apologize to them for using their friendship. Their wiretapped phone calls were then played for the jury, and there were plenty of them. In one call, Sabrina and Jonathan profess their love to each other, and Jonathan says that God has a purpose for them and a vision. He also says a prayer that Sabrina will know the right words to say and that they won't be suspected by law enforcement. In another call, Sabrina calls Jonathan and tells him that she is about to go to church, but that everything is fine and that the police told her that they don't have anything. Jonathan tells her that he will keep praying, and Sabrina thanks him for that. Jonathan tells her that God will save them. Jonathan testified that he spoke with Sabrina again later after that call, and that they had shared a mutual excitement over the fact that it seemed like the police were not suspicious of their involvement. But that excitement was short-lived. In regards to the November 10th phone call, where Sabrina calls Jonathan after hearing from Detective Meyer that DNA was found at the scene, Jonathan testified that his stomach, quote, hit the ground when Sabrina told him that. He said he asked her in the call to meet up with him because he was starting to get suspicious that their phones were being tapped and that the DNA collection story may have been a ruse to get them to talk on the phone. Later, they talk again, and Jonathan tells her that he thinks it's suspicious that Detective Meyer couldn't tell her more about the DNA process. He said he's bothered by the way the detectives are treating her and keeping her out of the loop. He says he can't help but think that the detectives saw their phone records and knows that they are involved. Sabrina says that's so crazy and she can't believe it. They ask God to guide the investigation, and Sabrina says, "I just want to live for God and for his purpose." The next day, Jonathan calls Sabrina and tells her that he saw a truck with two people who looked like cops in her neighborhood as he was driving there. He said they were obviously on the lookout, but he doesn't know what for. He said he thinks he might be paranoid, but the whole thing was weird. He tells her he's going home and not coming over. A few minutes later, Jonathan calls her again from a Skype phone number he had connected to his iPhone. He tells her that he's still coming over. She asks him to hide his truck when he comes and to park at the neighbor's. He tells her that he thinks his phone is being tapped and that hers might be as well. Jonathan testified that he called Sabrina back from that Skype number because he was hoping that if his phone number was tapped, the police would think that he was going home, meaning he could come over undetected. Jonathan told the jury that he and Sabrina talked about the investigation a lot, whether the police had any evidence, whether their phones were being tapped, and whether they really did have DNA. He said they replayed the scene and thought about if there were any ways he could have been detected or if there were any witnesses. He said they were beginning to realize that they were becoming the suspects. He said they weren't very street smart and were obviously taking the bait that was being set for them. He said the police investigation was very effective in that degree. Jonathan said that he and Sabrina had discussed not talking about the murder over the phone, that they agreed that they would only acknowledge their affair. Another phone call from November 13th was played for the jury. Sabrina calls Jonathan and tells him that she slept so super amazing. "Thank you, God," Jonathan said, and Sabrina repeats it. "We have so much to be thankful for," she says. She tells him that she feels good and at peace. "I really do," she says. Jonathan testified that during this time period, he was spending more and more time with Sabrina and her kids. They would go to dinner, go to the park together, on hikes, and to the beach. Jonathan testified that during the November 17th calls, when Sabrina tells him that Detective Meyer had the surveillance video of the man on the motorcycle and the secret witness tip telling them to look into a man named John, he was initially devastated. He said when he heard the description of the surveillance photo, he practically collapsed and said that he felt that they were closing in on him. He said he knew then that they were being recorded.
After that initial impression that they were probably closing in on me, I would say probably a majority of the phone calls from this night were fortified with the awareness that I was speaking to an audience, specifically this jury. Or rather, I should say, potentially my own jury.
In their next few phone conversations on November 18th, Jonathan tells Sabrina that he saw police vehicles in his neighborhood and says, clearly they're down here. He says he would appreciate her prayers and that all they can do is pray. This is so unreal, Sabrina says. She tells him that Detective Meyer hadn't yet called her back, and Jonathan says he's sure they're more focused on him now. It's okay, it's part of the process, he says. He tells her that he's planning on talking to an attorney. But they were both arrested a few hours later. On cross-examination, Sabrina's attorney, Richard Terry, brought up the fact that nothing Jonathan testified to could be used against him because of his plea deal. He also attacked Jonathan's testimony about having tried to poison Robert with the banana pudding. He said that Jonathan had said numerous times that Sabrina was a good mom, yet he was telling the jury that she had put poisoned pudding into her refrigerator at home, where her children could possibly be exposed to it. Jonathan had also testified that Sabrina told him that she had called Robert at work and told him not to eat the pudding. Terry asked Jonathan if he was aware that there were no phone calls from Sabrina to Robert's work during that time. Jonathan said no. Terry said the only evidence that corroborates Jonathan's testimony were deleted Gmails that police were never able to find. He asked if Jonathan will be about 50 years old when he's released, despite the fact that he committed cold-blooded murder. "That's correct, sir," Jonathan said and looked down. Terry said that Jonathan had testified that in June 2014, his plan with Sabrina to kill Robert was already underway. Yet he showed the jury a list of text messages that Sabrina had sent to Robert during that time, where she tells him that she loves him, tells him she hopes he's having a good day, and calls him Bear. Then, on the day of the murder, she sent Robert a text message that read, "Bear, I hope you are having a good day. I'm going to my mom's to visit for a bit. Call me on my cell. Love you, responder Rob." Terry asked Jonathan if it was true that he found out that Sabrina was seeing a former lover of hers after she had been released and while Jonathan was in custody awaiting trial. He asked, "Isn't it true that you only came forward after finding that out? You didn't feel any sense of betrayal?" Terry asked him. "I had already gotten over those emotions long before, sir," Jonathan replied. When it was the defense's turn to present their case, they called Sabrina's sister to the stand. She testified that she spoke with Sabrina on a daily basis in 2014 and that Sabrina and Robert had a good marriage. She said she was not aware of Sabrina's affair with Jonathan. On August 17th, when Robert was killed, she drove over to Sabrina and Robert's home. She said Sabrina was a mess, was crying and screaming. She said she was in shock at what happened. She spent the night there and held Sabrina's hand and rubbed her head. She said Sabrina was not handling Robert's death well over the next few weeks and months.
Was Sabrina, from your observation, struggling with dealing with Robert's death?
Yes. She wasn't eating. I went over there every day. And I took off work, and She was not doing well. She would collapse on the floor when the kids would be asleep, and I'd have to get her up off the floor. I'd dress her. She was a mess.
Sabrina and Robert's two children, who I'm not going to name, also took the stand. Their daughter, now 10 years old, testified that she loves her mom, and she recalled for the jury the day her dad died. She said both she and her brother were already in bed when she heard her mother screaming. She and her brother went to go see what was wrong, and they found Sabrina on the floor, crying. Their son, now 14, also testified for Sabrina's defense. When asked about Jonathan, he told the jury that Jonathan tried to act like his dad. He said Jonathan had talked to him about guns a couple times, but that he never told his mom about that. Asked if he liked Jonathan, the boy said yes. Prosecutor Smith didn't cross-examine either child. The defense then presented another witness, another married woman named Jennifer, who exchanged flirtatious text messages with Jonathan during the time he was having the affair with Sabrina. Jennifer said they met online and that Jonathan was very well-spoken, smart, and charming. She testified that Jonathan complimented her and flattered her. She said they only met once in person and that their relationship was innocent. And then Sabrina Lamone testified. She testified about her marriage with Robert and about their swinger lifestyle. When talking about Jonathan, she said he was different than anyone she had ever met before. She called him intelligent and said that he was like a human dictionary. She said that at the time, it felt like she had the best of both worlds, with Robert and with Jonathan. She said although she and Jonathan fantasized about being together, she was never serious about leaving Robert, that she couldn't imagine her life without him. She called Robert a great dad and a great man. She refuted the poison story and said Jonathan never gave her any banana pudding to give to Robert. She also said that she had no idea that he was researching financial payouts from life insurance policies or railroad benefits. On the day of Robert's murder, she said she talked to Jonathan, but didn't remember what they talked about. She said she had previously told him about Robert's work in Tehachapi, but not on that day.
I had told him about Robert's work up in Tehachapi and his workplace up in Tehachapi. And I don't remember when I did that or specifically why I had told him, if he had asked me or how it went, but nothing that was out of our normal. I mean, I told him every detail of my life. I told him always what was going on, where Rob was, because those were times where we talked or saw one another. So he always knew, and he knew details of everything about me and my life, fortunately.
Sabrina said she and Jonathan never talked about killing Robert, and she was unaware that he did it after Robert's death. She said she was in denial.
If you knew that Jonathan killed your husband, would you have been involved in a relationship with him after your husband was killed?
No.
Would you have allowed a man like that, if you knew that he killed your husband, to be around your children?
No.
Sabrina said that Jonathan was controlling and told her what to say to the police. On cross-examination, Sabrina said she doesn't remember what led her to specifically tell Jonathan where Robert's work was, and doesn't remember describing the warehouse to him. Prosecutor Smith asked her about her day on the day that Robert was murdered.
Now, in your first two interviews with law enforcement, you told them that you went to church. You told them that you were getting the kids ready for school. You told them that you went to your mother's house. You told him where the kids were. You told him that you had conversations with Rob. You told him that you called Robert over and over again and that you kissed Rob goodbye.
I did.
All that?
Yes.
What did you leave out of the list of things that you did then?
Jonathan.
You said you talked to Jonathan that day. Do you know how long you talked to Jonathan?
I don't remember exactly how long.
I added 223 minutes, 3 hours, and 45 minutes you talked to Jonathan prior to him leaving to go kill your husband.
I did not know he was leaving to go kill my husband.
Sabrina said she doesn't remember what they talked about that day, and Smith told her that it was the day her husband was murdered and that she should remember. Smith brought up the phone calls and messages from the day after Robert's murder, too. At 6:28 a.m., she sent a text message to Jonathan. She said she doesn't remember specifically what that said, but she remembers telling him that Robert was gone. Smith pointed out that she continued to text message with him that day, 12 times after that, and asked why she would keep text messaging him after telling him that her husband was dead. She said she doesn't remember. Prosecutor Smith showed her loving text messages that Sabrina sent to Jonathan in September, just weeks after her husband's death. She said her mind was scrambled and lost. She maintained that she had no knowledge of Jonathan ever killing her husband. The jury of 9 women and 3 men deliberated for about 5 hours before returning their verdict. Guilty of first-degree murder, solicitation of murder, conspiracy to commit murder, and accessory to murder. They found her not guilty of the attempted murder, of trying to poison her husband. Jonathan Hearn is scheduled to be sentenced on November 17, 2017. After the trial, Sabrina replaced her attorney and requested that her sentencing be delayed. The judge granted that request, and she is now scheduled to be sentenced on February 16, 2018. She faces 25 years to life in prison. And that's all for this episode. A special thank you to today's sponsors, Mrs. Fields and Virtue Labs. As a reminder, Virtue Labs is a new hair care brand with the goal of giving everyone the best hair scientifically possible via an incredible new protein, alpha keratin 60KU. Alpha keratin 60KU is identical to the keratin in your own hair and has the power to resurface and fill in cracks from damage, meaning more bounce, more shine, and more life for your hair. And now, you can only find it in Virtue Labs' line of shampoos, conditioners, and styling products. If you're ready to experience it, Court Junkie listeners can now try Virtue at 10% off and get free shipping using the code COURT. Visit virtuelabs.com to place your order. That's virtuelabs.com. So what are your thoughts on today's case? Do you think Sabrina helped plan the murder of her husband? Do you think Jonathan's plea deal, allowing him to potentially get out of prison by the time he's in his 50s, is fair? What are your thoughts on deals like that, in general? Let me know by joining our Facebook discussion group, which you can get to by going to courtjunkie.com/Facebook. You can also find me on Twitter at courtjunkiepod, on Instagram at courtjunkie, or you can email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. And if you go to courtjunkie.com/support, that will redirect you to my Patreon page, where you can donate as little as $1 a month to this podcast and get access to early ad-free episodes. That's courtjunkie.com/support. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.